and to never buy a property because you like it. What happens if your family grows, if you change jobs, for instance, and that requires you to sell your property, and all of a sudden you're not able to, you know, achieve the price which even you bought for. And then it just took a nosedive, you know, it went from dividends being withheld to share values taking a nosedive, and it's very difficult.
My name is Diana, and this is the Family Finance Show, the podcast to help you manage your family's finances better. Every week, we share an episode on topics relating to increasing your family's income and managing expenses, controlling your debt, and investing for the future.
Welcome to the Family Finance Show with Diana Granu, proudly brought to you by Old Mutual. This podcast is your weekly guide to effective budgeting, planning, and future-proofing of your family's finances, because money matters to every family, and every family matters at Old Mutual. Enjoy the show.
In this episode of the show, Vusi Matebula tells us about some of the pitfalls and mistakes he's seen from new property investors. We also discuss three different ways to invest in property, how to calculate your return on investment, and Vusi gives us a warning about property stockpiles. So Vusi, in my limited experience of property, I've come across three broad types of property investors. I'm sure there's more, but the ones that I've come across are those who build a portfolio of rental properties and those who buy a fixer-upper, they renovate and sell for a profit, and those who buy shares in property companies. So each of these different types of property investments require a different level of time and commitment. Do you have an opinion on whether one approach is better than another?
That's a very interesting and tricky question. Thank you for that. And I think you've probably just hit it almost, you know, on the nail in terms of the three types of investors in property that you'd normally find. There are more, but I think those are the main or the common ones. And quite honestly, there isn't a correct answer on this. It really depends on the kind of exposure that one wants to a particular asset class and the kind of risk that one is willing to take. I mean, in the first example where people buy a property and lease it, you know, you take risk on the asset directly, in that you have ownership of the asset and all of the problems that come with the asset are for you to deal with. You know, things like maintenance, rentals not being paid, and all of the troubles that come with that. That's the kind of risk that you take on board, and those are the risks, you know, that you have to live with as someone who holds and owns the property for rental. You know, you have to deal with tenants, evictions if it comes to that, money spent arbitrarily on things that need fixing when they're broken, depending on whether or not, you know, it's a cost for the landlord. You know, the second category of investors is, you know, what we'd call a flip in sort of call it property jargon. And again, that also gives you direct access or direct sort of risk in terms of the property, in terms of owning the property. But you're dealing with a different kind of risk in offloading the property, because you need to find a buyer to sell it, you know, and you're also dealing with the cost of renovating a property. And that comes with, you know, knowing and understanding the particular market that you're renovating for in a particular area, the kind of cost that you will be paying, and, you know, those costs escalate and getting out of control, and then finally being able to, you know, to sell that property. So, you know, that's a different kind of risk compared to purchasing, holding a property, and then leasing it out to someone else. And the third category, which is probably more suited to real estate investment trust, what is commonly known as a REIT, which is listed shares on the JSE. You know, it's a lot more passive than the first two, in the sense that you purchase shares in a property owning company, but that doesn't mean it doesn't come with its own risk, because you take risk on the company being able to perform and deliver on its strategy. And you also take risk on the shares, you know, fluctuating like you would in any other investment company. And in more recent times, REITs have really been hit hard, and especially under COVID, with less trading in shopping centers, which is generally where, you know, REITs are far more focused in leasing out office space, you know, retail shopping centers, in some instances, sort of warehouses and factories. And there's very few REITs that are sort of focused on the residential side of things, but we'll probably see a lot more of those come on stream as sort of the market matures. So really, there isn't a straight answer to that. It just depends what kind of exposure you want, what kind of risk you're willing to accept. But all of them come with one doing their base work in terms of research and understanding that particular market and the particular dynamics around that setup.
So you've been invested in physical property for some time. What are some of the common pitfalls and mistakes that either first-time property investors make, or that you've seen other people make, maybe that you've made yourself over the years?
Oh, goodness. Not doing one's research. Is the first no. I mean, I can't overemphasize how important it is to do research and to, you know, consult as much as you can with people who have more experience than you, and to really understand the markets that you are going into. And to never buy a property because you like it. I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that we tend to make. We buy a property because, you know, I like it. It's cute and all of this, and you know, it looks nice, and my friend lives close by, and you know, it makes me feel good. Never be emotionally attached to any property that you own. More especially if it's an investment. For me, you gotta follow the investment principles as what I would call them. And the first one being the purchase price. You gotta understand the purchase price and get the purchase price right. The lower you buy, the better it is. And also, I mean, when I say the lower you buy, I must be very clear here. It depends on the neighborhood in which you're buying, because, you know, people then go off this advice and buy any property they can find for 100,000 and say, well, he said buy low and you'll make money. No, it depends on where the property is located and what the median price is in that particular market. So you gotta come in, you know, at lower than the market. If you're looking to lease out the property, you got to further do your research and understand what your rental income will be and what that will mean in terms of the repayments for your property, especially where you've bought the property using bank finance. The second thing to look at is location. Location is extremely important. When you're buying a property, you really got to get that right. You got to understand the market drivers for the kind of people that you're trying to lease the property out to. You know, and it's got to be convenient, close to things that the people that you ultimately want to lease out to would need, as opposed to you liking the property and how it looks. So if your end user is a student, for instance, who attends varsity at the University of Johannesburg, it serves you no purpose to buy a property geared towards students at the University of Johannesburg in Midrand, for instance. You know, it's 40 kilometers away. It's just, no one's going to want to live there. Students want to be, you know, within walking distance of the university so that they don't spend money on transport. They would want the route to be safe, you know, so that when they're walking from university, they are safe and, you know, they're protected. And if you're going to be leasing out to a family, you'd want things like schools, hospitals, and shopping centers to be close by, and also, you know, work for convenience. So those are the things you'd need to consider when I say, you know, you need to understand the market, who's the end user, how much will they be willing to pay, and what kind of, you know, things would they want for convenience. And we haven't even gotten to sort of the asset itself or the property itself. You know, students just want, you know, call it a safe, comfortable space that is big enough just for the students with certain amenities, whereas a family may want more creature comforts in the property that they're looking to lease out. You know, the next thing really is understanding your risk dynamics. And I think it splits across all of sort of the principles, but as a standalone item, you know, depending on what you ultimately want to achieve, you need to understand the risks that are involved. You know, if you want to lease out your property, you got to understand that there may be tenant defaults, you know, that there may be maintenance costs that creep up on you at any time. So it may be helpful for you to build up, you know, a maintenance reserve fund, for instance, if you can, so that you can cover things that are not insured. For instance, you may need to evict people. Sadly, more and more of that is becoming common, considering the current economic climate. You know, and I think the last thing, you know, it also splits across all the principles is, you know, research. Spend time doing the research. I cannot overemphasize this. Really spend time doing the research, understanding, you know, the cost that is involved in acquiring the property, the kind of end user for the property, the kind of work you may need to put into the property to make it appealing for that particular end user. You cannot do, you know, enough research in my mind, and just be willing, you know, to learn and be fluid and as things change, to be able to move along with those things.
I made the first mistake that you mentioned here, which is a rookie mistake, which is overpaying for the property. So it's our primary residence, and yeah. And we did with it, and it was totally an emotional purchase. But we clearly realize now, like 5 years later, that we overpaid. But we also see it as a lifestyle asset or a lifestyle expense, and not really an investment asset. Whereas here we're talking about investment properties. But even more important in an investment property to not overpay.
No, certainly. And I mean, I even say this to, you know, to people who ask me the question, even on a primary residence, you know, even if you like the house, no matter how much you like it, at the end, at some point, it may catch up with you, because, you know, the asset may work for your family for, let's say, the first 5 years. What happens if your family grows, if you change jobs, for instance, and that requires you to sell your property, and all of a sudden you're not able to, you know, achieve the price which even you bought for? I mean, quite out of interest, I'm sort of in the market for a primary residence now. And, you know, I've walked away for a number of deals simply because they're overpriced. You know, even in this current sort of market and, you know, environment, sellers for some instance are still, you know, misled in terms of what they can actually achieve. And guys are trying to recoup money from when they overpaid sort of 5-6 years ago, and they're now asking for a lot, you know, sort of along the lines of that money, but only learning now that actually when I bought this property 5-6 years ago, you know, I overpaid by R1 million, and now I need to find that R1 million somewhere. It's ridiculous, you know, with some of the over purchases. So I always say, never be emotionally attached to a property, always be willing to walk away no matter how good it is. There's always another property that will come up in the market for the right price.
Indeed, yeah, like that's really great advice. What about some of the other benefits that you can get from investing in property versus other asset classes, and maybe some of the range of returns you've seen on your own property or investments or other ones that you've been involved in?
Yeah, I think the benefits for most people, you know, in property, and I think it's more of an ego thing. One of the bigger benefits, right, is that it's a physical asset. You can see it, you can hold it, you can touch it, you can point at it and say, "Look at that! You know, that those bricks and cement and concrete, that's all mine." Mm-hmm. You know, as far as the returns are concerned, again, all of this is vastly different. You know, and it depends on your numbers, really. How much debt did you require, to sort of acquire the property, and what you ultimately get out of it, where the property is located. For instance, I see a higher return on the properties that I have, call it in township markets, if you will, as opposed to, the properties that I have in more suburban areas. It depends also on the size of the properties. The REIT side of things, I think it's fluctuated quite drastically. There was a time when property stocks were doing really, really well and we're seeing really good returns. And then it just took a nosedive. It went from dividends being withheld to share values taking a nosedive. And it's very difficult, to calculate exactly when markets are going to go down and up. Although I think for now we can safely say the downward trend is going to continue for the foreseeable future, but there will probably be a point where it bounces up again, not maybe drastically up to sort of call it 2013, 2014 numbers, but it will come up again. So it's very difficult to put a finger on it, like I say.
So yeah, I agree with you. We'll see the calculating the return on investment is also quite complicated with property, because people forget about all the costs involved in buying and selling a property. So it's not just what you can sell the house for minus what you bought it for. You've also got to take into account all the upfront fees that you paid, the estate agent's fee when you sell, the interest costs. So the cost of debt, I think people just disregard that or they forget about it. The maintenance costs, all those things do add up, and you've just got to be hyper aware of this when you're going into a property investment. And I found some great articles on your website, so I'll link it in the show notes for the listeners, propertylink.africa. You've got some great stuff there on the business of banks. So you were talking about how banks finance loans, and you've got some really great, a really great article also that I liked on landlord versus tenant costs. So I think if you're planning to be a landlord, just go and read that article on Vusi's website, because you need to know what you are legally responsible for, what costs are yours. So we won't have time to, unfortunately, get into all of that on the podcast, but definitely a great resource for those people who want to find out more about property.
No, certainly. And I think just a word of warning that it's only a starting point. The things that are there, I think, just to help people get a sense of the things that they should be aware about. But I think encourage more people to do a bit more reading and understand a whole lot more of what you would need to do, for instance, as a landlord, if you decide to invest in property.
Yeah, there's a lot of homework for everyone to do, I think, before doing any investment of any type.
Teacher than experience.
indeed. We've all learned the hard way. When I started working, a number of my friends started getting into property investments. So this was in the early 2000s, and we weren't earning huge salaries. So people would get together with groups of friends or colleagues, and they would together invest in, say, a new apartment. So they would let it out, and they'd also look for capital growth over time. And I can understand why people did it, because investing in property is a really capital intensive exercise and very difficult to get into the ladder like so young. What is your opinion on whether is it a good idea to invest in a group with others, or is it better just to stick to yourself?
Yes and no. Right. Yes, in the sense that you need to find a group of people that is like-minded, and you need to structure it correctly. And there's a lot of work that goes into structuring it correctly. I know I came under a lot of fire for not being in favor of the so-called property stock fairs, simply because it's a nebulous term that really doesn't have a legal standing in our law, as far as asset ownership or property ownership is concerned. It's not something that is recognized, and I think things can go south quite quickly, and people taken advantage of, because if you're gonna own a property in a group, it needs to be done within one of the recognized legal frameworks. So it's either you're going to all as individuals be listed on the title deed, and that has its own complications and triggers a number of tax issues, or you're going to be part of a company, and that has limited numbers of people who can be shareholders in a company, or it's going to be in a trust or some sort of a partnership, and also all of that has its own dynamics and legal issues that need to be considered. Anything outside of that, I'd say be worried. So if you're a StockFell member and the people who have started the StockFell purport or it's kind of intimate that the StockFell itself owns the property, you're in trouble. In 99.9% of the time, you're being taken for a ride. And we also just need to be careful in distinguishing the terms when we speak about the terms, because there may be 10 of us that contribute money into a StockFell account, which is something that you can do. You can open a StockFell account with a bank, but then we funnel the money into a company account, which we've registered, and if there's four of us, all four of us are shareholders, because at the time we transfer the money into the company, we're no longer StockFell members or acting as StockFell members, but we're acting as shareholders, and some of us even possibly directors of that particular company, and the legal consequences are very different. Right. So we just need to understand those complexities. So, if you're going to do it in a group, you got to do it, I think, with like-minded people who have the same commitment and who have the same risk appetite as yourself. And I think in those circumstances, then absolutely it works. If it's done right within the correct legal framework, everyone agrees on the same risk appetite and everyone has the same commitment. If not, it's going to be an epic fail. I can guarantee that. And a lot of people are going to get burnt and lose a lot of money. Mm-hmm. The principle that I've applied, I've tended up until fairly recently to sort of go at it alone, having tried with friends and things not having worked out because people don't have the same drive or the same risk appetite, is to do sort of what I call the step up method. And it's a bit taxing, but when you just start working, you're quite correct, you don't earn a lot of money. So I'd say focus your investments on the lower end properties. Don't rush to buy, that two bedroom apartment in Sandton or in Midrand, because that's the one that seems like, the safe investment. Mm-hmm. Start off somewhere smaller where your money can actually buy you something on your own. And also consider living in the property. Actually, in fact, don't even consider living in the property. So actually live in the property. So if your money stretches as far as let's say Auckland Park as an example, where generally you have students living in the area, rather buy a property there and live in the property for 2 years so that you can adjust to sort of the costs that come with the property, and you can take the time to sort of fix the property. And probably after that period, your income at work would have gone up slightly and you've built a track record with the bank, and then you'll be able to purchase another property while leasing out the first one and you moving into sort of the second one. And again, that also helps you build a profile. And now you're sitting on the second step of the ladder. And I think if you continue to replicate that over time, and if you also, just from an investment perspective, never invest over a particular sort of monetary limit, because beyond a certain point, I think the risks are too high, as far as I'm concerned, in certain area, and beyond a certain size of property, the demand shifts and changes, and you just sit with a lot more risk. You'll probably be able to build up a sizable portfolio, over a period of time, which is what I've done, and it's served me quite well.
I like that approach. I think it's a really practical approach, especially for young people starting out. So we're running out of time, Vusi, and to get to my last question, which is the same as always, what is the one piece of financial advice that you would like to pass on to your children?
Oh, goodness. I say to them, everything is earned, including money. You've got to work for your money. You've got to work hard for your money. You've got to work smart for your money. If you put in the effort, it'll show itself. Everything starts with working. You got to earn it. No one is going to give you a free ride. So be prepared to work for anything that you want. If you're prepared to put in the effort, and to be smart in going on about it, then you certainly can make money.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast to stay on the journey to improving your family's financial well-being.
Thank you for listening to the Family Finance Show with Diana Granu, proudly brought to you by Old Mutual. The time is now to own your financial future. Visit oldmutual.co.za for more great advice, articles, free budgeting tools, and calculators, or to find a financial advisor. We'll be back next week.